Hello and welcome to the Oxygen Addict Triathlon Podcast. We're brought to you every week by our sponsors, precisionfuelandhydration.com. Personalize your fueling and hydration strategy so you can perform at your best. 15% off your first order of electrolytes and fuel with the code OA22 at precisionfuelandhydration.com. Welcome to the show, everybody. I'm your host, Coach Rob Wilby, and every week I bring you an episode of this podcast to help motivate and inspire you. This week, we've got a cracking interview with age grouper David Brown. David's recently returned from Kona after punching his ticket at Ironman Cork, and he's got a great story about really sitting down and working out exactly every second that he could find, practicing transitions, seeding himself higher up the swim, trying to take care of every detail in training. I've talked previously on the show about him setting up a plastic greenhouse in his garage with a wallpaper steamer going inside this plastic thing so that he can heat acclimate so he can get out to Kona and perform. He's a guy who left no stone unturned in his quest to get out there in the male 50 category. And it was awesome to see him punch his ticket with his seventh place in Cork. And we've got him back on to hear all about that race and all about his race at the Ironman World Championships out in Kona a couple of weeks ago. Before we get to talking about that, though, let's talk about the 70.3 World Championships that happened this weekend just gone. Dominating wins for both Christian Blumenfeld and Taylor Nibb. I don't know if you got to see any of the coverage, but I thought it was really good. I watched a lot of the coverage on both races and was really impressed by the way Ironman have lifted their game in the coverage of it. Both of these coverages of the races were really enjoyable, I thought. Really good camera angles all the time. We can really get into it now. And I'm old enough to remember when Ironman's coverage of races was not good and you had a single motorbike following one person for 35 minutes at a time. I thought it was really, really well done. On the men's side, like I said, win for Christian Blumenfeld. He pretty much took it to everybody on the bike, and hats off to Ben Canute. He hung with him on the bike and then he really tried to give it some on the run as well, gave a couple of good hard surges to try and get away, but Blumenfeld held strong. I know Ben Canute's had a tough year, so it's great to see him back racing really, really well. And Magnus Ditlev came through for third. If you didn't see the footage of this, Magnus, God bless him, ran out of T1 with his bike, but without his helmet, and had to leave his bike against a wall, run back and get his helmet. Cold conditions on both race day mornings, especially for the women. Ditlev put down his mistake to that. So yeah, tough work there. Gustav Iden, the battle we hoped was going to happen with Christian Blumenfeld just didn't happen. He dropped out partway through the run. He was already back in 25th place or something like that. And it looks like he was just mentally exhausted from Kona. God bless him, mentally and physically, as you can well understand, I suppose. On the women's side, like I said before, a dominating victory by Taylor Nibb. She was in a different zip code to all the other competitors that day. I think she came off the bike with a 7-minute lead. She was out of the water really close to the front. She took the lead on the bike really early, and that was it. It was game over. She had, you know, such a fast bike split compared to everybody else. It just looked like a different race for her. So incredibly impressed with her. You know, she's shown some amazing performances at Olympic distance as well in the past, in the PTO race and in other 70.3s. It's amazing to see her take the 70.3 World Championships. I'm going to try and hunt her down and get her back on the show and hear all about it. Actually, remember, we had her on about a year ago. So she's a superstar talent, still really young. And, you know, what a performance. She ended up with a 5-minute victory over Paula Finley, who ran through for second. So great to see her having another really good race after the PTO race in Canada. And our own Emma Pallant-Brown running through for third place. Got a feel for Lucy Charles-Barkley. She really held it together. There was her, Paula Finley, and Flora Duffy running together as a three, trying to close Taylor Nibb down. Emma Pallant-Brown made the pass with not very far to go and ended up taking that third place by about 30 seconds. So great race for Lucy. Shame for her to just miss out on the podium. But on the back of a great race at Kona after her injury worries this year, I don't think she will be too upset at all with that performance. And the only other thing to mention, I think, really, is there's a couple of very contentious refereeing decisions took place. Sam Long was taken out of the men's race with a what can only be described as a questionable refereeing call for blocking, when really it didn't look to me like he had anywhere to go. Iron Man published a post-race interview with a referee that said it wasn't the thing that was publicised at the time on the video. But I really felt for the kid. He's laid his season out on the line for that race. India Lee had a similar thing happen to her on the bike. Was overtaken by, I believe, by Holly Lawrence, and felt she had nowhere to go and got this 5-minute blocking penalty, and that's it, game over. So she was going really, really well as well, and I think she's got every right to feel as though it was a harsh decision. And I know that's the way racing goes sometimes, but it's a world championships, and if it gets ended by you know, the situations that they were in, you'd have to watch it on video to see why I think they were such contentious calls. But yeah, but there we go. Anyway, that's the 70.3 World Championships in the bag for this year. Next year, they'll be moving back to their traditional slot in late summer. I believe they're going to be the last weekend of August, and they're going to be in Finland next year. So moving over to Europe, if you are racing in the UK, you're racing in Europe and you fancy getting a slot, it's a great chance to get over there. I know they were hopeful that they were going to be able to have the World Champs in New Zealand this year, and it's been messed about by COVID. But if you want to race the 70.3 World Champs, there are lots of slots on offer. And to get the chance to go and race in the land of the midnight sun, as it were, in the middle of summertime, I think that'll be an amazing experience. So yeah, check that out. Okay then. Before we go to the interview of the week, though, I want to give a quick shout out to our sponsors, precisionfuelandhydration.com. Loads of you guys will have seen their bottles on bikes out in Kona. If you watch the coverage, there were the black water bottles that had the sort of rainbow coloured stripes around them. There was, now I don't know this for sure because I've not asked the guys, but I suspect they were helping a lot more athletes than they officially sponsor. I saw an awful lot of those bottles on athletes' bikes who are not headline sponsored by PFNH at all, but their products are the best in the world. And I think the pros are recognizing that they need all the help that they can get when they're racing in the heat and humidity of Kona. And PFNH are the world leading experts on staying hydrated, getting the right electrolyte balance in for you and your body and the race that you're doing, and getting the calories right for you and your body in the race that you're doing. So it's no surprise to me to see their products, their bottles on so many bikes in Kona, even their run hats on so many bikes out of Kona. So a lot of you will have seen Fenella Langridge was at the front of the women's race for most of the bike leg. Like, tons of Precision Fuel and Hydration stickers all over her helmet. The world's best are going to PFNH, so you guys should check them out as well. You can go to the website and you can use the free fuel and hydration planning tool. That'll give you a personalized strategy for your carbohydrate needs, electrolyte needs, and fluid needs, so you can refine your own strategy during training and then use it in racing. You can also book a free one-to-one video consultation with PFNH's athlete support team, and they'll be happy to help you nail your race nutrition plan and help you perform at your best on race day. As we're going into winter, you're going to be spending a lot of time on the turbo, maybe a lot of time on the treadmill. It's a great time to get used to getting the right balance of electrolytes in. That's going to help ward off cramp, and more importantly, it's going to help keep you hydrated, because it's more challenging than just getting the right amount of fluid in. You also need to replace the right amount of electrolytes as well. So get over to precisionfuelandhydration.com and you can use the code OA22 for 15% off your first order. Right, over we go to this week's interview of the week with age grouper David Brown. We're going to hear all about his race at Kona at the Ironman World Championships 2022. David, welcome onto the show. And let's start firstly by saying congratulations on Kona. I hope you're back and recovered well.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, it's been an experience, quite a full on amazing experience, really. But starting in Cork a couple of months ago, it's something that I certainly hadn't dreamt of this year. So it's just been a full on whirlwind for the past 2 months.
I bet. Yeah. Well, let's start there. Let's start by hearing all about the build up into Cork, because qualifying is 50% of the fun, isn't it, with these things anyway. So take us back to the race at Cork then, and let's talk through how that went.
Well, I've been with the team now coming up for a year. So I'd had what sort of 10 months worth of team OA training and coaching. That had really put me in a pretty good position going into Cork. probably about 6 or 8 weeks before Cork, I just picked up with Chris on the High Performance Programme. And that really sort of built up my picture of how triathlon works from being a, you know, having done quite a few races over the years of sort of swimming, then biking, then running, to actually putting it into the fact that it is actually one race and it's actually quite tactical, and how it all sort of fits into the one race. So that then that sort of fed quite nicely into Cork as for me what was going to be a practice race, putting everything into practice to see how well it all fit together and hopefully build into next year's program, which was going to be full on 100% geared towards qualifying for Kona. So obviously Cork wasn't meant to be the race where it all sort of happened.
You managed to take a shortcut there along the way, did you?
Pretty much, yeah, by about 12 months, so I'm not complaining.
Fantastic. Well, listen, let's circle around to the high performance thing a little bit later on, but
yeah, of course.
talk to us about your build up into Cork and the thoughts that were running through your head as you were going into Cork itself.
Yeah, I mean, the thoughts going into Cork were based mainly around two things, really. Initially around sorting the swim out, and secondly around just sorting transitions out. I mean, they were my two sort of main aims. The big one was I'd always had a sort of a reasonably sort of top end of average swim. I'm not the best swimmer in the world, and possibly never will be. But you know, sort of Chris just pushed this mantra of sort of confidence and putting yourself where you would wish to be, which was, you know, towards the front end. So going into Cork, it was all geared around getting into the sort of the sort of the top end of the swim, and doing that as well as I possibly could and with confidence, and also really just round about acing the transitions, because we all know that we should practice them. We all know what to do theoretically in a transition, but when it comes down to it on the day, most of us sort of mess them up to some in some way, shape, or
right.
form. You know, too much faffing around, dilly-dallying, and just dithering and messing around, and we end up with much longer transitions than we should. So I ended up doing some sort of standalone swim race practice, and also actually doing what we all know we should do but never do, and that's actually getting out on a weekend and practicing transitions on the bike, off the bike, shoes on, shoes off, all that sort of good stuff to make it nice and slick. And yeah, it all just came together on the day, really.
Okay, so what point did it stop becoming just about completing and become about let's take care of all the details for you?
I think that really only the penny only properly dropped in the build up to Cork, probably about a month beforehand. The sort of the realization, you know, you hear it said so many times that triathlon isn't a swim, a bike, and a run. It's a complete race. But actually letting that sink in and realizing what that means, you know, I certainly haven't done that before. I'd sort of gone out and swum to get a sort of what was reasonable for me, and then bike nice and hard, knowing that I got a run to do, so not biking too hard, and finding that sort of balance, and then getting on the run and just seeing, you know, just sort of getting through it reasonably. I'd never fully sort of really put it together as a full race from start to end. And again, that's where the team sort of the race planning came in as well, because I'd never actually written a complex race plan either. And I think that that helped going into Corp as well. Just having it all written down made me think.
Yeah, it's an interesting realization, isn't it, that there's more to it than just being fit for swimming and biking and running and then trying to swim and bike and run as hard as you can. There's thousands of other little details you can take care of that add up to, firstly, a much more enjoyable experience, and secondly, a much faster from A to ultimately Z experience on race day.
Definitely, yes.
Well, talk us through your race then at Cork. Talk us through how the swim, the bike and run all played out, because for people who've not been over and raced Cork, it hadn't happened in a while, had it as well? So,
no, it had happened. I think the full at Cork had happened once before.
And the swim had been cancelled, is that right? Am I right in remembering that, Chris?
I believe the weather was pretty rubbish.
It was horrendous, wasn't it? It was the year Ali Brownlee won, and it was just a bike run, wasn't it?
Bike run in the rain. So, you know, I haven't done it that year, but this year couldn't have been any different. They pushed it later in the year. It's now mid August. It was right in the middle of the sort of the second heat wave that we experienced over the summer. So, although it wasn't quite as hot as it was here in England, over in Ireland, it was certainly warm enough. And so, yeah, the race, it's a sea swim, going into a two loop bike course, not stupidly hilly, but it's a relatively hilly bike course. The culmination is at the end of each lap, you've got quite a steep climb, Windmill Hill, right in the middle of the town, 21% gradient to it of sort of 500 meters. That's quite an experience in itself. Tough crowds, 10 deep, real sort of Tour de France mountain stage experience, really, of screaming crowds. But the second loop, of course, you're doing that about 1.5-2K before you're into T2 to try and run a marathon. Marathon which was, trying to think now at the top of my head, was it four loops around the town. Probably about half it in town, in the town, and half it sort of out quite the edges of town. So yeah, sort of the run was sort of standard.
It sounds like, I remember from your race report afterwards, it was really well supported, that the locals all around the course really got out and got involved, and the level of support, even riding through villages, I remember you saying was phenomenal, right?
I mean, the level of support for the whole area was out of this world. The locals of the town where it's held, it's not actually in Cork itself, it's out to the east in a small sort of fishing town called Yall. The locals had really taken Ironman to heart. This was their race, and the place was crazy. You know, every house, shop, bar, pub, whatever, they had flags up, they had bunting up, they had displays, they had old bikes decorated with flowers and balloons and all sorts, and that went for the villages on the bike course as well. It was crazy. It really was.
It sounds amazing. Yeah. What was your personal race experience like then? You mentioned that one of the things you and Chris had talked about was backing the fact that you're a decent swimmer and getting yourself seeded at the start as if you believed you were a good swimmer. And I think Chris can probably talk more to this, but getting the athlete to see the reality of the athlete they are is sometimes part of the battle. And it sounds like that was maybe the case with you. Would that be right, Chris?
Yeah, totally. So in one of the very first conversations I had with David, we broke up the conversation into swim, bike and run. And I wanted to talk about each element and his history of each discipline, etc. And it was really interesting because David, when we got to swim, David approached the conversation as a quick, let's try and get through this part of the conversation really quickly and start talking about the bike and run. And so to me, that's, you know, as the coach listening, that's my first little alarm bell, especially if we're talking about an athlete who is talking about being towards the front of the age group and an athlete that, you know, has this ambitious yet realistic goal of competing at the World Championships in Hawaii one day. So I wanted to, you know, the first step for me was to slow that conversation down and pull it back to the swim of the reality is we can't be talking about being at the front of the age group if we're not even placing ourselves physically in a start pen of being towards the front of the race. We don't want to be chasing from literally the first 5 seconds of the race. We want to, you know, David is very much a good enough swimmer to be competing within the age group even before we get to the bike. So, you know, that's when we started talking about trying to get over this essentially fear of putting yourself within the swim race. And so we did some a local race to David, which was just swim. And I think that was kind of a first little moment, maybe, David, you can elaborate on this, but a first moment where you realized, why am I putting more weight on my shoulders of me not being a swimmer. Let me get rid of those shackles and let me realize that actually I am a very good triathlete and I'm going to start putting myself in positions to be able to fulfill my full potential in these races. And to me, I saw that it was visible. I saw that in the way you were communicating about your swimming. I saw it in the Training Peaks program. I saw it in the reports that you were sharing these experiences with other athletes within the team. And to me, it was a moment I saw with my own eyes of an athlete thinking, the swim is just to get to the bike. And now I see it as, you know, David is putting himself in a position to swim to his full potential to set him up for the bike and run. Is that how you see it, David?
Pretty much it. Yes, I'd always really just, it was like a lot of triathletes, I suppose. We swim because it's part of the race, because we enjoy the bike and the run.
And you were a decent swimmer, though. Like, I've got the results up here in the background. You swam a 104 flat. You were 10th out of the water in your age group. You're not a swimmer like me. You know, it's like really just doing the swim to get into the bike. So it sounds like there was a mindset shift there for you as well, right? As well as physically, you were already very capable.
Very much so. I would say that the time in Cork comes down to as much tactics as swim proficiency as well.
Okay.
The local swim race that I'd done a couple of weeks before Cork, I'd really concentrated on the sort of tactical side of getting on people's feet, finding a good swimmer and really just using the draft on the swim. I mean, that clearly worked exceptionally well for me in Cork. I seeded myself. I thought, well, you know, I've swum, I think a 111 was my previous best time on an iron distance race. So I thought, well, we'll go 105. And I got to the sort of front of the swim seedings that there wasn't a 105. You were sort of 1 hour or 1 hour 10. So it's like, what the hell? 1 hour. This is the group I'm going in with. So yeah, I went in towards the very start of the race. I think, you know, when the horn went, I was probably in the water within sort of 25, 30 seconds of the very start of the race. So right into the front pack swimmers. And I found myself in the water. It was sort of swim out a couple of hundred metres. And then there was a sort of a hard right at a turn point. You were out along the coast on the swim course proper. So that first 200 metres, it was in the water and it was just swim really hard to get that first turn boy and round it and then settle in and see where I am. And I guess I found myself with a small pack of probably five or six other swimmers and just sort of sat on the feet and helpfully towed all the way around.
That's what we need. That's the ideal situation, isn't it?
It certainly is. And it worked very well until the last part of the swim course, you come back up the coast and then you do a sort of a hard left into the sort of the small estuary where the town is. And there was the outflowing water from the river hitting the sort of incoming tide, I think. So it actually got quite a bit rough there, sort of lost people and very choppy. But that last, I don't know, sort of 400 metres or so, it was just hard work through the waves. But I think by that point, all the hard work had been done.
Yeah. Mm. Awesome. and you're released and free off onto the bike at that point, aren't you? How was your experience riding?
That was great. Now, this is where that quick swim really sort of paid dividends. And this was the part of the complete overall, it's a triathlon, not a swim, bike, run race package. It really started to sort of show, because coming out of the swim towards the front end and also having sort of aced the transition, really, you know, sort of practiced that the wetsuit was off in sort of record time for me. And I just didn't stop through transition, you know, none of this sort of stopping to put your helmet on. I'd sort of grab my helmet and sort of ran putting that on as I was running through transition to grab the bike. But of course, I then find myself out on the bike on quite a quiet bike course, really. You know, all the other athletes that I'm used to being around were sort of, I suppose, just coming out of the water. So now I've got this new experience of being on the bike course with a few of the cyclists around me, but actually not that many. So straight away, I can race my own race. You know, I can ride my powers. There's none of this cat and mouse with other athletes. There's none of this surgy business of sort of overtaking. So all of a sudden, I'm in this new experience of just being able to sort of ride my powers and really sort of dictate my effort level and the sort of the largest part of the race, which of course the bike, and you know, knowing that what I'm going to do now is sort of deliver myself onto the run, having not killed the legs. Yeah, first time for everything.
It sounds like it allowed you to, it gave you the freedom to ride to your race plan when you're not concerned about other people around. Was that your experience of just, I know what my power numbers are, I've got to ride to these, on the hills I'm this, on the flats I'm that, and off you go and deliver it?
Pretty much exactly how it was. I mean, I've got my sort of power numbers. In the past, I've used Best Bike Split, which is a fabulous tool. But under instructions from Coach Chris, he said, well, you know, you know what you're doing here. You know what you're doing on the bike. He said, take it as a guide, but, you know, ride to how you feel, because, you know, you've got enough experience to know whether you can shoot above these numbers or whether to just reel it in a bit. And it's pretty much what I did. The first lap, I just stuck with what my numbers pretty much were, and it worked out quite nicely. But with the second lap, the temperatures were getting up quite significantly. It was getting a bit of a hot day, especially inland. So I sort of reeled the power back a bit and just sort of pulled it back a bit, because, you know, at the end of the day, this was my practice race. It wasn't, you know, I wasn't going all out for Kona here. So, just race smart and see what it leaves you with at the end. So
I think that's a really interesting point about how you pace that. And I think this also has a knock-on effect in your future races, and including Kona. But for the listener, I'm definitely an advocate of Best Bike Split. I don't want anyone to listen to this interview and say, oh, well, David didn't necessarily use it on race day, so maybe I shouldn't. I'm going to caveat it by saying every athlete's different, and you kind of have to make wise decisions based on many, many aspects. But my kind of conclusion that I came to with David is that he had so much race experience for distances. He knew his body really well. Within training, he's meticulous with whether he's using heart rate or power. That I wasn't too worried that he was going to stray away from the wise decision at that moment. And over the kind of length of an Ironman, so if we, you know, talk about roughly a 6-hour ride, within that 6 hours, there's huge ebbs and flows. And that, you know, those ebbs and flows are determined by emotion, how you feel physiologically, hydration, nutrition, conditions, wind, etc. And I just felt that David was getting to that tipping point where maybe he was using, or he was at risk of using data to his detriment. And maybe there would be a point during a race where he's actually going to be chasing a bike split number, even though physiologically at that specific 15 minutes, let's say, that may not be the wisest choice. And it may be that wisest choice to actually maybe just focus on aero and just focus on getting in the nutrition at that time and let your watts drop by 5, 10, 15 watts. And in the long run, you'll make those watts up later. And even if you don't make them up on the bike, you'll make them up on the run. And I just felt that, you know, David's obviously a very clever guy and got a huge amount of experience, and he's very good at listening to his body. And so I thought that it was the right time to kind of transition away from using the data as the main indicator, but actually using data to back up how you're feeling and just using it as a, okay, I'm feeling like this. The data suggests that I'm maybe dropping back, and that's okay. And so, you know, it's a subtle difference of how you use the data. But I think for the listener, maybe as you evaluate your last year of racing, see how you use the data within racing and training, and ask yourself the question whether the data is making you race better, or actually at times it's pushing you to do irrational decisions. So yeah, I found that very interesting with David as well.
Mm. It sounds like you used it as a cap rather than a target, which is really smart, because I don't think anybody's ever regretted backing off a bit on the second half of the bike in order to save their legs for the marathon. And it sounds like, you know, as we've said, Best Bike Split's brilliant, and it gives you some really great rigid guidelines if that's what you need. Then to perform within those, it's never a target to reach. It's always a cap to sit under. I think that's the way to look at it. And you sound like you've protected your advice from Chris worked really well with your mindset to protect your marathon, which, as we'll find out, worked out really well.
Well, it did. And I have to say, I mean, I did run quite a few different scenarios with Best Bike Split before the race anyway. But chats with Coach Chris, it was basically around, you know, that is the ideal framework for a 100% performance on a 100% day. And as he said, you know, as with the swim, you know, to sort of back myself, and the same with the bike, you know, Best Bike Split is giving you, you know, perfect numbers, but on the day, you know, evaluate things on the fly and change as needed. And yeah, and on that second half, as I say, especially inland, the temperatures were really getting up. So yeah, I mean, I backed off the power, and having had my Botterill bike fit earlier in the year and getting some really good gen from him, and really concentrated on that second half on using the sort of the aero tools at my disposal, just really tucking in, shrugging the shoulders, making myself as small as possible on the front, and I was quite surprised for the drop off in power that I'd allowed. You know, I was still getting some pretty decent overall speeds anyway. So, you know,
it's very smart that it's a way of thinking about the speed and the minimum you need to do to maintain it, rather than the watts and the maximum you need to do to put that out. Because, you know, we all know, don't we, that the power numbers don't always translate into speed, and vice versa. That the smarter detail orientated things is learning to stay as aero as you can and to save the power as much. Tell me about the run then. How did you feel getting off the bike, and when did you realize you were having a decent performance on the run?
I mean, towards the end of the bike, of course, you've got your second transit of you know, sort of cracking on up Windmill Hill with all the excitement that entails with the crowds, etc. But from the very top of that, having pretty much spiked your heart rate a little bit, you've then got, I think, about 2 kilometres of sort of steady downhill into T2. So I'd sort of thought this through. I thought, well, I'll do my climb of Windmill Hill, and then that 2K downhill is just that's my rest period. So I just let the bike freewheel, a bit of easy spinning in the legs to sort of, you know, sort them out, and then a nice easy spin into T2. So in my head, I was going to dismount the bike, and at that point, that's where the run started. So coming in towards T2, feet out of the shoes, up to the dismount line off the bike. And as soon as I hit the ground there, that's it. The run had started. I'd had my rest. My rest was that 2K leading. So through transition, got rid of the bike, ran into the tent, grabbed my bag. It was literally a few seconds sitting down long enough to put my shoes on. And then I just grabbed my hat. I'd already prepped it. My gels and sunglasses were in the hat. So as I ran out of T2, that was it. And I could put my sunnies on, stuff a couple of gels in my back pocket as I was running out. So again, it was an exceptionally quick for me T2, and I was sort of straight out on the run, feeling pretty decent, to be fair, after a reasonably arduous bike in the heat with a couple of cheeky climbs thrown in there.
Did you have any sense during the marathon of where you were relative to your, did you have anyone giving you splits and where you were in your age group, or were you just running blind the whole time?
You know, I didn't. I knew that I was front end coming out of the swim. I mean, my girlfriend, she was there. She shouted my swim time as I came into T1. So I knew I'd done well there. And I knew when I came into T2, I mean, you know, straight away as you're running in, and there are very few bikes back in transition. So you know straight away that you're sort of reasonably well placed. And again, you get out onto the run and you realise that there aren't many people on the run course. So, you know, it's quite nice to know that you're sort of out the front end. But of course, what you don't know is that people starting later in the swim might have been catching you up. They might, you know, behind you at that point. But so I didn't really appreciate how far up the age group I was. My girlfriend was out on the run course cheering and shouting and screaming and holding up a pint of beer as I ran past, but at no point did she let me know that I was actually quite close to the front of my age group. So yeah, I mean, I had a reasonable run. It wasn't my best run, but it was certainly not a shabby run either. It was tough. It was a hot day, but again, the local support from the locals in Yall was amazing. You know, that they're all out in their gardens with hose pipes, showering the athletes as we ran past. So, you know, plenty of opportunities for cooling. It was a tough run.
Yeah. And you wrapped it up. I've got the results here. You snuck under 4 hours and you're 3:58 and changed across the line.
Yeah.
But that's really only where the story starts to really get interesting for us, isn't it? We were watching along at home and saw you cross the line in seventh place in the age group. Mm. What point did it become apparent to you that you were top 10, that there was the chance of maybe even going to the roll down ceremony?
It was after I crossed the line. I sort of, once I got into the recovery area, got my white bag, got my phone, had a quick look at the results, and it's like,
oh,
yes. Wasn't expecting that. And it wasn't, I think we're about 120, 125 in the age group. So again, it wasn't like they're only 10 in the age group or anything. So that was a pleasant surprise. And I had thought if I'd known that I was so far up towards the front of the age group on the run, I might have been able to pull a little bit more out of the bag. And possibly even get one or two more places. But, you know, that's in hindsight, isn't it?
So roll down ceremony then the next day. Yeah. What talk us through that. Talk us through the experience of finally getting given that Kona slot.
Well, yeah, that was an interesting one, because obviously it was the following day and I'd spent the evening, obviously couldn't sleep because standard Ironman, caffeinated gels, a cup of Coke at every aid station on the run. I was absolutely wired all night. So, yeah, I had a quick look at the guys that had finished in front of me. And then on my iPad, I dragged up the current Kona start list, realised that three of the guys in front of me had already qualified at other races. So all of a sudden, I am effectively fourth place for a Kona spot. And I thought, well, you know, I'm in the 50 to 54 age group. It's one of the bigger age groups that was racing. So we had 45 slots in total for the race. I thought, well, you know, could be in with a chance here. So we'll go to the roll down, see what happens.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And what did happen? Come on, tell us a story.
Well, they went down the roll down for the different age groups, and I think they started. They did the women, sorted all their slots out. Then they started with the men. They started with the older age group men, and where am I? So it was the age group above me, 55 to 59. One of their slots wasn't taken up, so that then, you know, it was said, well, that then rolls down to the next biggest age group, which is 50 to 54. Boom, they already have four slots. That makes five slots. And I thought, well, I'm sort of number four. You're if in. Everybody in front of me takes a slot, so yeah, I'm in.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was a surreal experience, I think. Wasn't expecting that, but yeah, and there we were.
Well, congratulations. I mean, it's one thing to get your Kona slot when you've been working for years and years and just missing out roll downs, but to get it the first attempt and on what wasn't really even in your head the kind of qualifier attempt, that's fantastic. Let's go fast forward in time then. Let's go on to Kona and tell us about your experience at Kona, because I know a lot of the listeners be massively jealous that you've managed to get a roll down slot. I want to hear all about the experience. So I know you had to fly out quite late before the event. Yes. Tell us how it was for you when you got there, and then we'll go back and we'll circle back with Chris and talk about some of the specific training that you did to get
ready. Of course. Yeah, I mean, the timing wasn't ideal. So I was racing on the Thursday race. Thursday race was all the women plus some of the older male age groups, plus one of the young guns age group, having the 20 to 24 age group as well. So, yeah, I landed in Kona first thing Tuesday morning, 11-hour time change, to try and get the hang of, and going from sort of pleasant late summer, early autumn temperatures in the UK to the sort of 30 degrees, 85% humidity of Kona. It was, it was
a bit different.
A little bit different. But you know what? The pair of us, we arrived at the airport, got the taxi into Kona town, and the place was buzzing. It was a triathlon dream. It really was. You know, there were people in every triathlon team you could think of, you know, or different colours from all over the world. You know, everyone had their sort of local club or team vest on. The people running, the bay was full of people out swimming. Yeah, it was proper crazy. It really was. It was just triathlon everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. And were you, In terms of like getting there and feeling the heat, I know that you and Chris did a huge amount of work in preparing for the heat and humidity. Chris, do you want to talk a little bit about some of the specific horrendous things you had this poor man do to get ready to race in the heat?
Well, to be honest, I'm not going to take any of the credit, but at the same time, I'm not going to take any of the blame. So David is, I'd say he's quite a unique athlete in that he actually does a lot of the research himself, and he takes on the responsibility, and he is very open to ideas and guidance, but essentially he knows what he needs and wants. And sometimes just to bounce a few ideas here and there goes a long way. But at no point really did I set out the exact plan that David was going to do. He did his own research and bounced that idea of how he's going to structure it and what kind of changes he's going to make at home to enable him to do the specific heat prep. And essentially I gave him the green light on the vast majority, if not all of it. What became pretty clear with David to start with was that it was not going to be realistic to make him go and do specific sauna sessions due to logistics and work and all these things. And so David came to the conclusion that actually, if I can't outsource that, I'm going to bring it at home and make it really specific to the conditions that I want. So I think in a minute, David can talk us through exactly how he transformed his house into some sort of strange pain cave. But over the period, so he had a 2-week period where he did 14 specific heat sessions, which is actually a lot. And a lot of the science will back up that he did that in a correct way. And even I think if we're going to go through the whole process again, I don't think we'd be adding a huge amount of that. 14 fairly short and sharp sessions back to back to back is going to go a long way into preparing you for those conditions without having too much of a compromise on the sessions that we really want him to do. And so it'd be very tempting to go and do a 1 or 2 hour horrendous heat session on your turbo or even, you know, sauna sessions, etc. But in a sense, that's gonna be counterintuitive, and that's gonna have a knock-on effect on, maybe it might be as simple as his sleep or whatever. And I was quite keen to wrap David up in bubble wrap and just do the session short and sharp, but then get back to your regular recovery and training. And I didn't want to kind of revamp his total lifestyle or training habits, knowing that actually David has got to this point by doing incredibly good training and recovery. And so therefore we just need to refine what he's doing as opposed to starting from scratch. But at this point, David, I think you're best placed to share the kind of specific heat preps that you were doing and how you adapted your turbo sessions, etc., with the at-home improvements, let's say.
Right, yes. Well, obviously, Chris, you opened my eyes to the whole heat acclimation training, which I then sort of backed up by really sort of finding out about, sort of Googling and finding out that there were two protocols, the sauna protocol, which, as we said, wasn't really going to work, seeing as I don't live near anywhere with a sauna. So the other one was a hot water immersion protocol. So that basically involves getting into a 40 degree bath for 40 minutes after a sort of an exercise, either a turbo session or a run session, easy session either way. So get your core temperature up with the exercise, and then jump into the hot bath for 40 minutes. Yeah, it sounds quite pleasant, really, on the, you know, just sort of chill out in a hot bath. But
I don't think anyone's thinking that, David, to be honest.
Well, I don't know, yeah. It's usually quite nice to chill out in a nice hot bath. But, yeah, I give me VO2 max intervals, hill sprints, hill repeats, anything, but that hot water immersion was awful. But yes, I under direction from Chris, it was based around the 14 sessions. It was based around all zone 2 work on either the turbo or the treadmill. I'm very lucky in that in the last few years I've sort of converted my garage into a bit of a gym, so plenty of room in there. I've got a treadmill in there, and I've got my turbo. So I went out down the local DIY store, got myself a temporary greenhouse which sat quite nicely over the turbo, which meant that I could get the temperature up in that. And to give myself a bit of a head start on the turbo, I also got a nice wallpaper steamer, so I could get that going 10 minutes before my session to make sure that the air inside the greenhouse was nice and hot and really humid. So that was quite nasty. So we're doing sort of 30 minute to 1 hour zone 2 sessions on the turbo in a nice steamy atmosphere. Or it was a nice zone 2 treadmill session, which again I would wear a thermal base layer and then a waterproof jacket over the top, and do my run sort of steaming nicely, sort of boiling the bag in my waterproof jacket. And then from either the turbo session or the treadmill session, I'd already got the bath run, so I was straight inside into a 40-degree bath for 40 minutes, and it was awful. It was one of the worst things I've ever had to endure. Oh. And I was just watching the clock tick down, just desperately wanting to get out of this hot bath. Of course, I've got my thermometer, and the temperature dips and goes more hot water. Yeah,
I was keeping a close eye on David during this period because all in all, his comments post training sessions tend to be very positive or data driven, essentially saying I hit the targets or slightly over or under due to this. And then when we moved into the heat work, all the comments were negative, basically. And this is not against David at all. It's just that's the reality of it. We've got a positive guy who's willing to do everything to give himself the best possible chance of performing in the heat. And I'm just looking at his comments to refresh my memory. And basically, over these 14 days, he's trying to be positive by saying it's getting slightly better, but then it's still awful. And every comment is, I think this is helping, but it still feels awful. And you know, to give the listeners an idea, for example, on one session, he lost around 3.6 kilograms of body weight in an hour and a half, which is pretty significant. And so, you know, that is getting the sweat rate through the absolute roof. And then you've got to think you're sleeping, and then you're doing the same again the next day. And so the body is, you know, it's basically being thrown into shock, and it's going to have to adapt to the stresses that you're putting it through. And you did really well to essentially stick religiously to it day after day after day, despite the, I'm sure in your mind it was saying, well, what the hell's the point of this? This is not what I signed up to triathlon for.
I did drink a lot.
Yeah, I bet you did, yeah.
For about 2 weeks I was, performance, fuel and hydration, I mean, they must have made a fortune out of me over those 2 weeks.
Yeah.
It sounds like a really brutal, draconian regime, but I think that the bigger thing to realise for anyone listening is that's what's going to happen when you get to Kona. If you don't prepare your body, and if David hadn't learned that he's going to lose 3 kilos of liquid in an hour on the bike, they're the conditions that you're going to face out in Kona. Firstly, you've got to get your body prepared for it. And secondly, you've got to find a way to learn to understand, to mitigate that problem when you get to Kona. Otherwise, you're one of the statistics at the roadside who isn't even finishing the ride, let alone getting out onto the marathon. So let me ask you this, David, did you gain mental confidence through doing these sessions that was going to help you when you were out in Kona? Did you have more belief in yourself because you'd done those tough things that, you know, let's be honest, not a lot of people are willing to do?
I think so. I think the penny really dropped, or didn't really drop until race day, as to how significant that preparation had been. On race day, on the bike and the run, I had extremely low heart rates. I.e. what you would normally see. I was high 130s, low 140s on the bike, and sort of high 140s to the very low 150s on the run. So considering the temperature I was in...
Yeah, it speaks to that acclimation having happened, because so, you would see a ridiculous rise usually, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I mean, having not done that sort of heat acclimation training before, I was very much sort of swung by the sort of the data behind it and you know, the proof that, you know, this does work. But having not really experienced it or experienced how well it works, I was sort of pinning my confidence and belief on the science. Having got to the race and raced the race, then it actually spoke for itself in that, you know, it clearly had worked, because there was no way I would have been racing in those conditions with a heart rate that low without some form of sort of acclimation to the conditions. So yeah,
And let's remember that David was doing all this heat stuff during the trickiest phase of training. It's not as if, you know, you're feeling fresh and, you know, of course you're motivated, but I'm sure there were voices in your head at times saying, no, I don't want to do this. And I think it's, you know, if you know someone or you are that person that has been through a real big build-up towards a major event like this, at times the motivation is really tricky to balance. At times in the morning you may feel extremely motivated and you just can't wait to go and do that hard session, but at other times you just can't be bothered, and you know, you've got work stresses, family stresses and all these things. And to imagine going to go and do that turbo session in horrendous greenhouse conditions, or getting yourself into that hot bath when you know you could just be having a nice glass of red wine on the sofa watching Strictly Come Dancing, which I know David's a huge fan of, it's just this other element of, oh god, this is serious training. And this is, to be honest, this is age group training at its absolute best. You know, professionals have extra motivation because their livelihoods depend on it. And I just find it beautiful when you see an age grouper who's got all these life stresses and is still willing to kind of give these events the absolute utmost respect.
And so still I think willing to do what it takes.
You can hold your head up really high, David. And whatever the race performance was, I was just incredibly proud knowing that you'd been through that process and I'd seen it, and I know it wasn't easy, but you did it, which is, yeah, it's really, really good to see.
Yeah.
Well, talk us through your race experience then. Come on, talk us through the whole, you're in Hawaii, you're swimming with the fishies. Talk us through race day.
Well, I mean, I was there. That was the biggest thing. I was in Kona. It's one of those sort of the dreams that you have, but you sort of don't tell people because, you know, they'll laugh at you because it's a massive thing, isn't it? You know, it's one of those things that we all like to sort of think of, but we never actually really believe that it could possibly ever happen. And yet there I was. I was in Kona. I was race morning, going through to sort of sort out my bike nutrition, going through past all the volunteers. I don't know if it's a standard American race thing or if it's a special sort of Kona thing, but the volunteers were all there giving the athletes a round of applause as they filed through. It was, you know, it was quite a moment, really, when you sort of realise that, you know, this is it, you're here. Sort the bike out and then wait by the swim start, slowly file into the water, swim out to the swim start. Crazy, really. And
where did you place yourself in at the start of the swim?
Right. Yeah, I'll set the scene. So one of the larger age groups, again, I think starters on the day, there were 575 starters in my age group. So that's a lot of people. So me and 574 other people, these are people who have qualified at races around the world. So arguably some of the best Ironman swimmers in the world. So where do I place myself in this little lot? Right in the middle, right at the front.
That's the spirit.
Yeah. And, you know, chats with Chris had always been around, you know, back yourself, be confident, you know, don't be fazed. So that my mantra for the race was, well, you know, what's the worst that could happen? So yeah, in the middle, at the front, horn goes and we're off. The water around me just erupted. I'm not a bad wetsuit swimmer. In fact, I'm a really decent wetsuit swimmer. Yeah, my swim technique could obviously do with some fine tuning. Without the wetsuit, I'm still a decent swimmer, but against some of the best Ironman swimmers in the world, I was just hoping to swim hard, swim confidently, and find some feet. But I have to say, the first half of the swim, all the way out to the boats at the turnaround point, all sorts of various assaults, punched, hit, slapped, jumped.
You got the full experience then, did you?
I got the full experience, but I'm pleased to say that I kept my confidence. I didn't allow myself to be fazed. I just kept swimming. I just kept swimming through it. Took the punishment, swum through it, and you know, got to the turnaround point. A couple of boats out in the bay. Got round those and on the swim back in, everything was a little bit calmer. You know, I found some feet and had a reasonable swim back. Could actually enjoy being in the water, looking at the fish. Nice blue sea. It was great to swim back in.
Nice. That really sounds like a swim of two halves, doesn't it? Mixed martial arts on the way out and then nice and serene on the way back.
And you know, it didn't knock my confidence, but what I did find, I got my legs hit quite a lot, which sort of pushed me down in the water and put me in not the best swim position. So yeah, my swim suffered. It wasn't the swim I was hoping for, but you know, it was 121 in the end, which isn't a bad swim. But you know, I was hoping for a little bit faster. But you know.
You're in Kona, you're out, you're onto the bike and you're out, ripping along on the Queen K before you know it. How was your experience of the bike leg?
Yeah, again, I got out of the swim and this is where I had a little bit of an oh no moment because I realised I'd got a bit of a sore throat coming on.
Right, so okay.
I think everything was sort of catching up with me, to be honest, but you know, I was out on the bike, and the first part of the bike is great. You do a bit of a loop around Kona town, a bit of an out and back. So there's quite a lot of support, and you start to settle into the fact that, wow, you know, this is it. I'm on the bike. I'm in Kona. It's great. And then you hit the Queen K, going out into the middle of nowhere, and then you sort of realise that actually, the thing about Kona is it's so difficult, not just because of the heat and the humidity, but you've got this black ribbon of tarmac stretching out into infinity. You know, it just goes on forever. And it's a featureless volcanic landscape. And you realise very quickly that actually this is very much a mind game. You know, it's not just about pedaling out your bike course with a few bits and pieces along the way to take your mind off, you know, a bit of scenery, some corners to think about. It really is just sort of settle in and you've got nothing to distract you from what's going on in your head.
That seems to be a really common comment, isn't it, from people that come back from Kona. They, especially maybe from the UK and Europe, maybe it's a little bit less for those riding in the States, but we're not used to riding on those straight, long highways. And it is soul sapping. It's very difficult to keep your head in the game after a few hours. But looking at your data, David, it looks like you did manage to keep your head in the game because you rode a 6:10 and your first half, so 3:05 on the bike, your average heart rate was 140 beats a minute. With your watts were around 150, just below 148, and that gave you an average speed for that portion of 18.4 miles per hour, which, having seen your data in the lead up, that's exactly the ballparks that I was hoping. And it actually looks like you did stay aero for a long period of time because you're putting out, for you, a low amount of watts, but you're remaining a high speed, which is brilliant. And then if we compare that to the second half, so the next 3:05, your heart rate drops slightly to 136, which is only a very small drop. And your watts were very much the same ballpark, 145, and the speed was 18 mile an hour on the dot. So overall, as you know, tactics, strategy, pacing, power output, average heart rate, and the lack of heart rate drift really shows that you absolutely nailed your bike plan. And I think you raced on intuition, but then looked at the data to as a bit of reassurance to let you know that you were on the right track. But correct me if I'm wrong, David, but I was really pleased to see how you paced that.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't feeling 100%, and I did feel that my power was down a little bit from where I wanted it. Not a huge amount, but I just didn't feel. I didn't feel bad. Mm. I didn't feel like I had weak legs, but I just didn't sort of seem to be able to just put out those few extra watts to where I sort of wanted to be.
It does sound like everything caught up. You know, you had so much travel in the lead up and obviously a huge amount of stress with training and life at home and all these things. But all in all, when we just look at the data, you know, if you told me that you had a really solid, great day on the bike, I'd believe it from the data. Which is really good to see.
Yeah, so certainly consistent. I mean, the whole thing was sort of based around just keeping in that aero position, which generally I managed for the whole of the course apart from a little bit of the climb up into Harvey.
Yeah.
It wasn't stupidly windy, but the wind certainly got up and a little bit of a climb there. So come out of aero a bit there, but for the most part, and especially on the way back, because there was quite a headwind all the way back then. So it was really beneficial just to be as aero as possible, just to offset that headwind.
Did you feel as though all that work with Botti had paid you back dividends at this point then?
Oh, massively. Absolutely massively. Yeah. I mean, there's sort of, you know, getting a bike fit and riding aero, and then there's just getting those hints and tips and a proper bike fit from someone who really knows what he's talking about. And all of a sudden, you're doing your sort of FTP intervals in training in a solid aero position. And then that just means that when you go out onto a sort of an iron distance bike course, that your position is sort of solid, and the sort of watts that you're putting out on an iron distance race, you know, you're comfortable in a very aero position. And yeah, so that work has been absolutely massive over the last sort of 6 months.
Fantastic. And also I think has the other benefit, it pays you back in terms of, as well as being fast for relatively low watts, it also has this dual effect of saving your legs for the run.
Yeah, certainly does. Yeah.
And so, how was your experience on the run at Kona then? Talk us through that.
Again, that's not even a game of two halves, really. You've got the first quarter, maybe first quarter to a third, and then you've got the next two thirds. So the first bit's great. Again, it's out of transition, and you run around town, and you've got a nice out and back along Aliti Drive. So 12K in and around Kona town, loads of support, people going crazy on the sidelines, absolutely fabulous, just taking it all in. A real boost as well to as I was sort of running out towards the turn point to see Emma running the other way. So big sort of shout out either way going as we passed each other there. And then, yeah, you do that little bit. You've got sort of 10, 12K down. So you're nicely over quarter of the way through the marathon. And then you are back out into the Queen K and very much nothingness.
That's where dreams are made of.
Yeah. Isn't it? Yeah.
To give the listeners an idea of the kind of run we're talking about, David did a marathon of 4 hours, 22 minutes, which I think is very solid.
Yeah.
Very solid.
Very solid.
And I know it's, I mean, I personally believe that it's not David's full potential, and I'm sure he'll feel the same. But as a first time out in Kona, arriving 2 days before, off a solid bike, hot temperatures, all these things will have a knock-on effect. And we've just heard that, you know, potentially he had the early signs of coming down with sore throat and illness. So actually 4:22, when you wrap that up, is very solid. And how that was paced, the first half marathon was 2 hours, 3 minutes, average heart rate of 145 beats per minute. At an average pace of around 9 minutes 29 per mile. So that set you up, you know, you were very much going towards a fantastic run. But things in the second half, which is very common in any marathon, but especially in Kona, second half marathon was 2 hours 19 minutes at a slightly lower heart rate of 140, and the pace dropped to 10:26 minute per mile. So all in all, I think you did everything you can to set you up for the best possible run. I don't think you went out too fast. It's just that everything caught up with you. So you've got elements of illness, but you've also got elements of you're trying to run your quickest ever marathon in Kona. So actually, you know, from a coach's point of view, when I saw that data, I thought he did everything he can to put himself in the best possible place to get the best possible result. And even with the benefit of hindsight now, I'd still say, to be honest, go and push that first half marathon like you did, because I know that you've got the talent and the training was there to replicate that in the second half. But it just so happens that this is sport and nothing's predictable, and unfortunately you had some, you know, some illness to battle there, but all in all, you know, I think you can be very proud that you even finished the bloody thing at this stage. Many would have seen that as a bit of an excuse to pull out with early signs of illness, but I think that was a very, very solid run.
Well, yeah, I was in Kona. There's no way I wasn't getting that medal.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was it's tough, but the one thing I kept running, wasn't always pretty, wasn't always fast, but I was of the mindset that I wasn't going to be one of these guys or girls that was broken by the side of the road, that was just walking it in. So, I mean, I walked the aid stations, always walked the aid stations, took my time to fill my tri-suit with ice, front and back. I've tried filling my hat with ice, but it was a little bit painful with the old brain freeze. So I was taking the time to sort of, they had great big vats of ice and icy water. So I was soaking my hat in cold water, getting as much sort of cold stuff over me as I possibly could at each aid station. Yeah, that was working, and I was running between aid stations, and unfortunately, Ironman hadn't been able to muster up the volunteers they'd wanted for the race this year, so they cut the aid stations down. So the aid stations, instead of being a mile between them on the run, they were now down to, I think, sort of 1.7 miles. So on a normal race, that's fine, but on a race that's so hot and taxing out there on the run, it's not ideal.
I think there's a long way between aid stations when it's so hot. It doesn't sound like it is when we're talking, but I'm thinking back to like racing Ironman France, where they were a mile apart, and I can remember getting soaking wet at the aid station and being completely bone dry by halfway to the in half a mile. Yeah, so I can imagine how difficult that was. Yeah.
I also think there's an element psychologically, which is that you know there should be an aid station at this point and it's not there. Whereas if from the start, you know, historically the aid stations were always at 1.7 miles, there probably wouldn't be too many issues because we all know that that's the norm. But when you know that it should be there, and, you know, the previous years you'd have probably been chucking ice over yourself at that point, it starts to play on your mind when the wheels are slowly but surely starting to fall off. Very difficult.
That was about making the right turn then, coming back and you make the right turn to head down towards a race finish with a mile to go. How are you feeling at that point, knowing you were going to get your medal?
Well, at that point, amazing. It was just one of those crazy moments coming down Palani Hill as you're coming back into Kona town. All of a sudden there's people again, you know, supporters, people cheering. So straight away it's getting better. And of course you know that you're close to the end. So it's a bit easier to keep that pace up. In fact, the pace was nice and high down towards the finish, and getting down the bottom of the hill, right turn onto Aliti Drive, and that's it. Loads of people everywhere, running, faster, faster, faster all the way. And then you sort of hit the carpet. My girlfriend was there shouting and screaming and cheering, which, you know, it's always, she's there at the end of every race. So that's always fabulous.
Is it possible to put into words what the main emotion was that you had, that you felt?
It was, I think, just about every emotion possible, to be honest. I just couldn't believe that I was on, you know, having had, you know, plenty of red carpet moments over the years, to be on that red carpet. And Mike Riley, the voice of Ironman, he was on the microphone. So coming under that finisher arch and hearing the voice, the original voice of Ironman, call me an Ironman, was just unbelievable. You know, it was the culmination to the day. It really was, you know, to actually make that finish line again at that point. Times don't matter. You know, you're there at Kona on the finish line, being called by the voice of Ironman. Yeah.
That gives me goosebumps. That's brilliant.
Amazing. What difference would you say working with Chris made in the final preparations for you?
Yeah, I would say all the difference from the moment I started working with him on the high performance program on the lead into Cork. It really is. It's the icing on the cake. You know, you've got the cake, you've got the training. The Team OA training plan is fabulous. You know, I mean, the whole thing behind Ironman training is being consistent. And, you know, you, Rob, put the training plan in place. I bring in the consistency with the training. But then Chris brought in the icing on the cake, the detail, the real attention to detail, the things that, again, that we kind of know we ought to be doing but don't. He kind of puts it into focus that, yeah, you know you need to be doing this, so, you know, go out and do this. So it's all the detail. And what it comes down to, actually, is that, you know, we can all go out and train and run, you know, a decent race. But to run our best race, you've got to put that attention to detail in. And, yeah, that's what Chris brings to the game.
Fantastic. I'm loving this idea of you having been out practicing your transitions out in the street and in the garden and then being like the fastest person through transitions at Cork. That's brilliant. And it really, I think it's more though than just going through transition quickly. It's a change in mindset that says I'm going to do everything possible to treat this as though I'm trying to get from the start of the swim to the end of the bike as quickly as I possibly can. I'm going to take care of all the details. And you're right, it's not just fast transitions. It's have I got the right amount of sodium in my bike bottles and everything in between. The fact you were willing to go and do that, I think, is absolutely credit to you. You're right, we all know we should do it, but there's a very small number of people who are willing to do the hard work to actually go out and do it. So it falls to me to say, well done. We're very proud of you for all your efforts at Cork and taking care of those extra minutes. And that's paid you back by getting you to Kona a year faster than you even hoped would be possible. So well done.
Thank you.
Well, I've actually got a tangible metric that we can put on this, because I get quite a few emails each day from all sorts of athletes. But I've only got one email in my inbox, which are videos of someone in their car park actually filming transitions. And that's from you, David. And I don't know how many emails I've received this year in total, but there's still only one that has a file, which includes video footage of transitions. So I think that's probably a lesson for all of us, that if you actually want to, you know, make these gains and these differences, and transition is just one example of many areas that you can improve on as an athlete, go and do it. Don't just say it, actually go and do it. The other thing I was going to say just before we wrap up is, I think David's performance is a fantastic one, and one that you should be proud of, and you should be for the rest of your life, David. The other element is how highly, highly competitive Kona is. And that's just not the pros at the front, but it's also this particular age group of 50 to 54 males. You know, David did a 12 hours, 5 minutes in horrendous conditions, not feeling particularly well on the day. And I went through the results, and in this particular age group, it's roughly for every 5 minutes saved, you jump around 12 places within age group. So even if someone just focuses on transition, you can hop 12 or so places, which is phenomenal. And David's transitions were pretty good on the day. 4 minutes for the first transition, which is actually towards the front of transitions in total. And then T2 was 6.5 minutes, which is also brilliant. So I think you stuck to, your original plan. You made yourself proud as an athlete from getting from A to B, including transitions, including nutrition, including heat prep, all these things. It was a phenomenal process to watch, David. It really was. So, yeah, thank you for giving me a bit of an insight and allowing me to kind of see behind the scenes from the first moment that we spoke to this moment. I think it wraps it up really well.
Excellent. Well, that's Coda baseline is set. So see if we can improve it next time, eh?
Absolutely.
Well, the final question is right there. Will you go back? Is that a thing you'd like to do? Would you like to go back in the future and have another bite of the cherry?
Right. Well, Thursday night after the race, I said absolutely never again. I will race any iron distance, anywhere else in the world. But Kona was just a beast. It was awful.
So what did you think later, on Friday?
So a few days later, I'm thinking, right, well, actually, no. I want to go and beat this. I've seen what I can do, and I know deep down that on a better day I can do better. So yeah, watch this space.
Good man, that's brilliant. That's
awesome.
All right, David, thanks very much for your time, mate, and congratulations. It's a lifelong dream of a lot of triathletes to get to Kona, so we're really chuffed for you, and you made it happen with a lot of hard work. So remember to sit down and give yourself a pat on the back for that later on.
Cheers, thank you very much for that. No, it's been great talking.
Well done, David.
Cheers, thanks.
Okay, guys, I hope you enjoyed that and I hope it inspired you and I hope it gave you some motivation, because I don't know about you, but for me, listening to stories of people who have dedicated themselves to this, they've really found every single last thing they could have done, practicing transitions in the driveway, doing the heat acclimation work, everything that you need to do to have a successful time out in Kona. It really inspires me to go and apply it to myself and go away and be the best that I can be in whatever it is that I'm doing. So I hope if you're one of these athletes sitting at home and dreaming about going to Kona next year, you'll go away and you get a pen and a piece of paper and you'll start to make a plan for the things that you can do differently over the coming year to give you every chance of getting yourself to Kona or getting yourself to complete your first Ironman or half or whatever it is. If you've got that goal out there you want to complete, I hope you take the time to sit down, even if it's just 5 minutes with a pen and paper, and work out a couple of things that you can do this week to make you better than last week. And on that, if you're interested in finding out about triathlon coaching with Team Oxygen Addict, I think we've got the most comprehensive triathlon coaching program for busy age groupers out there. You've heard David talk today about the coaching with us, and this isn't a sales pitch, but it's worked really well for him, and I'm really confident it will work really well for 99% of people. So if you want to find out more and find out if you'll be a good fit for our team and the way we coach people, book a call with me or the team. There's a link in the show notes that goes straight to our calendar where we can carve out 30 minutes to have a good chat with you, find out what's going on in your life, and find out the ways that we can help you be even more successful in 2023. And also a shout out to precisionfuelandhydration.com. Remember, you can use the code OA22 for 15% off your first electrolyte order. And remember, guys, there's links in the show notes for all the sponsors, so you don't have to remember them. Until next week, have a great, safe training and racing week. I'm Coach Rob Wilby, and you've been listening to the Oxygen Addict Triathlon Podcast. See ya.